basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-court stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away.
Bryant for the win. Bang! James puts up the three. Oh, it's good.
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in. 5 tenths of a second remaining.
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius. And D, here we sit on July 27th, and there's still a whole bunch of business for the league to be handling. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. We got one of the major dominoes to fall in LeBron. And then over the course of this weekend, Spencer Jones signed an offer sheet with OKC, which was subsequently matched by Denver, who's now over the second apron, only team in the NBA that fits that description, while having Peyton Watson unsigned. So today's pod, we're going to try to make as much sense of it as possible. And I think a good place to start, D, is to sort of lay out what is the business that the league still needs to handle. We've got a lot of restricted free agents. Draymond and Harden are still unsigned. What's on your mind in terms of just the stuff that needs to happen before now in training camp?
First of all, Pete, the Spencer Jones thing was interesting to me. I can't recall if we checked in on this too much, but were you a little bit happy that someone put Denver's feet to the fire in this way?
Hell yeah, Ben. I wish somebody could do that with Peyton Watson with a legit offer sheet. And that's one of my concerns, is that this might drag out through the rest of the offseason on the restricted free agents, which is going to have a domino effect on everybody else.
Yeah, I thought OKC and Presti trying to sort of kill two birds with one stone. They traded away their own wing depth in Joe and Wiggins, and then obviously Dort, and they're, I don't think, too keen on relying on rookies to fill in every single role, or Topic, and is he ready, and everything else. So getting a guy like Spencer Jones at $6 million, I thought would have been good for them. It's also why I think it was imperative that Denver match that offer sheet. It's just not enough money to be like, I'm going to let a guy walk. I understand there are tax implications to that, and it pushed them over the second apron, but I just don't think you can sell that any other way besides we're being super cheap, that you're going to let a guy who I think was in their top 7 or 8 in terms of minutes played last season and just let him walk over nothing for like $6 million. Anyways, but it did put Denver in a weird position, and it did push them over the second apron, where now, because they're over the second apron, they're very limited in the stuff that they could do. It's my understanding they can't even execute a sign-and-trade for Peyton Watson. They would have to do it without taking any salary back at all, basically.
And what team is in position to be able to just absorb Watson without sending anything out?
Especially a team that wants him, right? And so there are teams with trade exceptions or whatever.
Yes.
So they could potentially execute a sign-and-trade for him using a trade exception, but there's not a team out there with cap space to say, trade me into the cap space or anything like that. And so you need a team with a trade exception that is at least big enough to absorb him at the salary that he wants to make as well, right?
And that's like Milwaukee? I think it's like Milwaukee, Boston.
Yeah, Milwaukee has a big one from the Giannis trade. Charlotte has a huge one from the LaMelo deal. Boston has a big one that's going to expire soon, I think, as part of their operations last season. I think it's like $25 or $27 million. But there's not a lot of big trade exceptions around the league. And in tying this back to sort of what I'm looking at, there's just these dominoes, Pete, that I'm just wondering what is holding up the Draymond signing, for example. What's holding up the Harden signing? The stuff that's going on with the Clippers and the Kawhi trade, I think, is another little bit of a domino, because the Clippers are supposedly in on Peyton Watson, or would like to try to get at Peyton Watson. They were a team earlier during the offseason that had been linked to Kuminga a bit. They had their own restricted free agent and Ben Mathurin, whose name hasn't come up at all
right,
in terms of anyone like, I want Ben Mathurin sort of deal. And so I'm looking around the league, and this goes back to the Lakers' pursuits as well. Like, with Jonathan Kuminga unsigned And with Denver now in the second apron, I see all of this connective tissue around the league as to the guys who remain unsigned and rosters that are just not yet built out. And so a team like Golden State, they've got what, like 11 or 12 players under contract? Mm-hmm. They've still got guys that they need to sign. I think Denver has 10 guys under contract. Minnesota still doesn't have a starting power forward. The Lakers still don't have a starting power forward. And then when you go back to Draymond being unsigned and Cleveland clearly trying to maneuver some things in potentially still a pursuit of Jonathan Kuminga and Harden being unsigned, I just feel like, okay, it's about to be August. And
crazy.
There's all of this league business with real players out there,
yep,
and their futures uncertain, or at least we're getting the same reporting, I feel like, over and over again. Interest in this guy or interest in that guy or a holding pattern with this stuff. And I thought LeBron was going to be the domino that triggered a lot of this stuff, but LeBron signs and then it's like Spencer Jones and Mario Hezonja. Where's the real stuff that's going to happen still? And as a Lakers fan, I'm feeling the sort of anxiousness about, like, some of these things need to trigger to get the ball rolling downhill so that the Lakers are going to know, are they going to get their starting power forward or is this going to be the team that they have? And I'm sure there's various comfort levels in either of those directions, but I know which way they're leaning because the pursuit has been on for a long time, right?
Yes, it has. And that's why when we had brought up the idea of LeBron being a domino, I would always add on to that, I think Peyton Watson is one as well, and like what's going on in Denver. Because with that signing, like you said, pushes them over the second apron. And my understanding is that if they were to sign Peyton Watson to, say, a contract that started at $25 million a year, that adds like $180 million to their tax penalties. It's just ridiculous. The second apron is so punitive that it does ostensibly operate as a hard cap, along with all of the flexibility issues of frozen draft picks down the line. And you can't aggregate salary. You can't take salary coming back in if you're over the second apron, like you said. And so Cameron Johnson is one of the characters that I think is most pertinent to Lakers' business. The way that they've moved with Kuminga, and my understanding of the Kuminga situation is it's like, Kuminga either wants good money long-term or a one-year deal, like a prove-it deal type of thing, where the Lakers can't offer that in a sign-and-trade. It can't be a one-year deal in a sign-and-trade. It has to be at least three. And two of those years could be non-guaranteed, but that doesn't benefit Kuminga, right? And so they're trying to negotiate for more money within that. But the way the Lakers have moved have been, well, we've got some degree of alternative here that I've always had my eyes toward Denver and Cameron Johnson for that. And so let's go to break here, D, and when we come back, I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Let's zero in on the Kuminga piece first, Pete, because I also want to make clear that the Lakers are only $8 million, or less than that now. I think it's $7.7 million.
Yes, it is.
Under the first apron, right?
And they're capped at that.
Yeah,
because of the Kessler sign and trade, yes.
Yes, and because of the Kessler sign and trade, they are hard capped at the first apron. And so the ability to take Kuminga in at a big number is somewhat limited, right? They can essentially only take back about $7.5 million more than what they send out in a trade. And there's a bunch of legal ways to do that. We have talked about this on the pod a bunch, and I know that Jovan has hit on this as well on the Lakers Collective pod that you all do as well. That said, the podcast that you did when I was on vacation with my feet in the sand and enjoying some rays out there was super informative about the Lakers transaction cycle plan for the next 3 and 4 transaction cycles. And the ability to step up their spending in levels requires a certain amount of discipline now as well. And so I actually don't think the Lakers are super keen on being like, we'll just pay you $20 million a season for 3 years, because that could inhibit their ability to use the full MLE next season or to use a combination of most of the full MLE and the biannual exception and still remain under the first apron to have the flexibility so that then they can go out maybe a year after that and be like, well, we can spend all of the way to the second apron and be fine. And I think that this is a multi-year idea of being able to ramp up their spending to a point where they've built out a championship level team, both for the present time, but also to be able to say, we can give our players raises, we can make trades on the margins, we can add salary in trades or whatever, and get to be a more expensive team while still competing. And you don't want to thwart that future flexibility by saying, let's just pay Kuminga whatever he wants right now. And so I think the Lakers are not constricted, but they understand the pathway, and they're going to show discipline within this idea of, we want you. We want you to fill this role. We see you as a long-term piece, but that long-term piece has to fit within the larger plan that we're building out, because we're not building a team around Jonathan Kuminga, Pete. We're building the team around Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves and Walker Kessler, and Kuminga can be a part of that, but so could several other power forward options, which I think goes to your point about a guy like Cameron Johnson or any other power forward around the league who has a skill set that slots into what the Lakers are trying to do. And I think that that's actually a broader spectrum of player than sort of the athleticism stuff that we've been highlighting, especially when you look at, okay, what's a Deuthero going to be? And can you get some of this internally? So I think the Lakers' options are out there, and they are trying to preserve that flexibility and optionality beyond just this summer.
Yes, very much so. And that's the whole idea of the Mr. Right versus Mr. Right Now, is I don't think it's simply, well, they're holding the line on Kuminga because they've got other options to trade for this summer or right now. That may be the case, but what could also be the case is that they've made that exact determination of, if we give Kuminga too much at this point, that's going to thwart that future ability to improve down the line, where it would be preferable to hold the line and see if young players can develop, and Adu, you know, Carr, guys like that can sort of internally do that. Also, on the forward point, more and more I'm thinking the Lakers need a small forward. Like, between Kessler and Luka, those are two guys I want around the basket defensively as much as possible. And so perimeter defense is my number one attribute that I find really important in this spot. So we've been talking a lot about the four and the power forward spot, D, but for me, it's actually a small forward.
Well, to me, I'm looking at a combo forward, Pete, a guy who could play power forward when Luka's not on the court,
for sure,
but could defend perimeter players and be more of a small forward when Luka is on the court. And this is why Kuminga is so appealing. But to me, Pete, it's also why a player like Cameron Johnson is appealing. And so I do want to get back to this conversation about recentering him as a target for the Lakers. He makes about $23 million this upcoming season, a little bit more than that, 23 point something. But he's also on an expiring deal. And I think the Lakers are willing to pay a guy this much money and would maybe even take back more salary beyond him if it meant them trading out other guys that are currently on the roster to sort of slot things appropriately. But what do you think of him as a fit on this team? And if putting them side by side, how do you feel about him versus Kuminga, like irrespective of salary, just in terms of skill set fit?
This exact question has been occupying my shower thoughts for about the last 3-4 days. And I've gone back and forth. And today I actually prefer Kuminga this morning and thinking about this more and more. However, it's close. One of my concerns with the starting group is all our best shooters right now come off of the bench, between Carr, Colin Sexton, and Mamu. But Grimes shot 33.7% from three last year. He's a better catch and shoot guy, and I'm more bullish on his three-point percentage this year in the role that I think he's going to be playing in, but that's no guarantee. The three-point shot is one of the things about Austin's game that can come and go. Luka, I put in a different category because so many of his shots are on ball and pull up, but I'm just talking about the guys that can finish from three off of Luka's creation, especially. And then we're talking about Jonathan Kuminga in that other spot, who's a career 33% three-point shooter, not one of the strengths of his game. And Kessler, I think we're going to see him shoot some more from three, but that's not like a main thing that he does. And so the Lakers starting group neither has that soar in the sky, 12 feet in the air type of pick-and-roll lob threat like a Daniel Gafford, nor like real snipers from three. Now, I'm actually okay with that, and we're going to do a pod soon about them building around Luka and sort of what this team looks like in relation to Luka's skill set. But having Cameron Johnson in the starting lineup as that guy who's going to be playing at the free throw line extended or out of the corners, that's what he does for a living, and he's very good at that. That I think having a dependable three-point shooter in that spot would be superb. I think he's an okay defender. He plays hard and he's got decent measurables. He's, you know, he's tall. He's not somebody I would want really to scale down a whole lot, but I think he's a better help and team defender, like an IQ type of guy that I think sort of fits within the framework of the Lakers' overall defense, in that I think they're still going to do a lot of switching. I don't think it's going to be 1-5 type of stuff, but I think they're going to do a ton of 1-4 switching and maintain a lot of the defensive principles from the last couple of years, where it's like, we're going to send baseline into help, we'll peel off switch a decent amount. That you just need smart guys that know that, oh, I actually need to do this right here in this moment. That I think Johnson fits that. And I know him and Redick have some history. I know he was on the pod and
he took over his pod.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He took it over. So he's the guy now. He's the young man in the
young team. Man in the
that's right. The old man.
That's right. I believe he's CAA as well in terms of his agency. And so I would like Cameron Johnson for sure. But on the other side of things, he's not that lockdown wing defender. He's 30 years old. He is expiring, which I do think has benefits to it as well, in that I think you could re-sign him with bird rights to probably a lower deal than what he's making right now. And if you liked him, you could continue to build around that. But I do think the starting group could use one guy who's a super athlete in that front court spot. And all of this is part of the reason why I think I still have a preference toward Kuminga at 23, who has some on-ball defensive capability. Again, not a lockdown guy for other reasons, right? But does provide a certain high level of athleticism. But it's a back and forth for me, man. Let's go to our second break here. I want to hear your thoughts on that same question.
It's funny because I've gone back and forth as well. And for all the reasons that you said, I actually prefer Johnson. I would love an athlete at that spot. I would love a guy who has a bit more on-ball ability than Johnson. I get the appeal of Kuminga, and I'm not someone who, even after watching him, I think I have a bit more grace for him than others. Even with his contract stuff that he's doing right now, it does annoy me. I also totally understand
this
perspective. And I get that it falls into a pattern with him of this, oh, well, he doesn't know, yada, 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 and he should fire his agent and X and Y and Z and everything else. All I know is that if you're locking me into a long-term deal, I want it to be for a lot of money. And if it's not going to be a lot of money, then I'd prefer a short-term deal so that I could go back into the marketplace and maybe make the money that I want to make. And who can't relate?
Sure.
So there's a part of me that's just like, are the optics around it not as friendly to him, or is it easy to make fun of or whatever? Like, sure. And I also understand it.
And what was the last year, D? It was the same thing that we're seeing with Durin and Watson and Mathurin. Teams are more and more squeezing these restricted free agents who are not free at all, where that's exactly the position Kuminga was in last year. Like, why is he any different than Watson, Durin, and all of those guys?
100%. But now I flip it back to the other idea of, all right, however much blame you want to put on Kerr and his coaching staff and what happened with the Warriors and everything else, it didn't work out for Kuminga there. Then it was supposed to be a fresh start in Atlanta, and I get that he's blocked some because Jalen Johnson is playing in front of him, and there's not necessarily the clearest pathway for him to sort of be the player that he envisions for himself. And so I get it, but now this is going to be his third team, potentially. And in his two previous stops, it was like the same sort of deal. And so it's like, fool me once, fool me twice.
Sure. If I could provide a little pushback, though, on from Atlanta, they had, what, a $24 million option on Kuminga?
Yep.
I wouldn't want him at that either, right? Now,
that's right.
I don't know to what degree they would still want him. And there have been a smattering of reports, at least, that they have some interest in him. They have a roster crunch and they've got too many guys, right? But I don't view the Atlanta thing. And all they did was trade Porzingis for him. It was sort of a expiring for expiring type of thing. And he played pretty well for them. They were like 10 plus points better with him on the court. That was the only team to take two games off of the Knicks in any playoff series. And he was part of that, right? And so I feel like he is somebody that is often viewed through that deficit model where just because Atlanta turned down a $24 million option on him doesn't scream to me like, oh, they want nothing to do with that guy.
That's totally fair. And it's one of the reasons why I'm not down on him. This is why I'm saying that I might prefer Johnson for the exact reasons that you laid out of his fit within the context of this specific group. Mm-hmm. And does Johnson have some deficits that I would want? Yes. But Kuminga has deficits totally. That I would want in terms of those to be filled in as well, right?
It's and very close for me as well. Yeah.
What are the things that I'm willing to live with? And I think I would prefer the steadiness of the team defensive player, more veteran, has deep run playoff experience as a high level contributor. He was on that same Suns team that Ayton was on. And a guy who is, and I'm not saying this isn't true about Kuminga, but I will highlight this about Johnson, that is good in the locker room, a good teammate, seems to be a thoughtful dude about what his role is within the league. And just seems to be like a plug-and-play guy.
Yes.
What Kuminga offers is upside, and he offers upside in terms of skill set. He offers upside in terms of athleticism, and he offers upside in terms of, like, he is and wants to inning eat. He wants to be out on the court. He wants to play a lot of minutes because when those minutes come, he's proven to be productive. And I do think that the shots he would get in this sort of offense, playing off of Luka and Austin, that don't necessarily require all of the make the extra pass, ball movement, play. He can do some of that stuff, but the idea of him being a finisher within the context of the Lakers offense is super intriguing to me. And I would argue that Kuminga plays his best on both sides of the ball when he has some of that offensive utility. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like he would get more of those opportunities within the Lakers offense. And so I am intrigued by the defensive tide being raised by his offensive. I'm hungry for this. Let me get some of it.
I have a team building question for you before we move back on to the sort of league business as a whole. One thing that I think puts it over the top for me with Kuminga, just barely, is if you were to, say, sign Kuminga to a deal that starts at 15 a year, 16 a year, something like that, and we've been talking about the Lakers possibly taking Buddy Hield back, as if they were to take Vando, that's a way to sort of square it, because Atlanta's got some tax issues and a roster crunch as well, where it might be beneficial to Atlanta for them to trade off of a Buddy. And so, like, Vando, Dalton, and draft compensation for Kuminga and Buddy. If you were to do something like that at this trade deadline, you'd have Kuminga, but then you'd also have the expiring contracts of Hardy, Buddy, and Jake, which adds up to like $21 million, which means you could take back up to 29. Well, there is the first apron cap, though.
Maybe sure, yes.
So that's sort of my question to you, is that are you able to add up more cumulative talent if you were to get Kuminga in that sort of deal rather than the $23 million that Cameron Johnson is on?
This is an excellent point, and that's where the pendulum might swing in the other direction, in that the closeness between Johnson and Kuminga as players to me and how they might fit within the team structure that the Lakers are trying to build out, that's then the tiebreaker could definitely be, what's the structure of the deal? And what do you then offering, and how can you make it work? If the Lakers were to trade for Cameron Johnson, or they were to trade for Jonathan Kuminga, I would imagine that both of those deals would be three-team trades because of the need to maybe help Atlanta with a roster crunch issue, and saying, we don't want to do a two-for-two trade. We'd much rather do a two-for-one trade where they maybe only take back Vando in that scenario and not Dalton or not Hardy, and someone gets routed to another team, right? And I would also argue that in the case of the Denver deal, Denver might want to expand their trade as well, right? Like, they may want to include additional bad money besides Cameron Johnson and be like, well, if we're trading Cameron Johnson, can we get off of Zeke Nagy's money as well? Yep. And can we incorporate a third team into this where maybe we send out draft compensation ourselves, like if you're Denver, but then get back useful players who are cheap and who can then backfill the rotation and the empty roster spots that Denver's currently trying to manage. And in both of those scenarios, I think you then have to judge, then it's bigger than just the individual talent from the player that I'm getting back. And Buddy Hield could also be a useful player for the Lakers as well. Mm-hmm. Just even if it's just in terms of competition, I think we all would love to see Cameron Carr step into a role and be like, I'm competing here and I'm getting minutes and I'm getting the opportunity to refine my NBA game and get experience. Flip side of this is if he's not ready, then who is going to play some of those backup minutes? And if you have a veteran alternative like Buddy Hield, who is a sharpshooter, who is a guy who can come in and spot up in the corner and get the sort of open looks that Luke Kennard was getting last year. And instead of starting the blender, which Luke was great at and really helped facilitate the offense, is just firing up threes and getting them off quickly, Hield would be a very good guy to actually play in some of these lineups. Now, are there defensive issues? Yes, there are, but I'm talking about building a deep enough bench where you feel like, hey, players 11 and 12 and potentially 13, we're comfortable putting them into the game. And tacking on a player like Hield would be something that I'd be like, if you're getting off two guys who you don't necessarily want to play or you don't envision being a part of the rotation, and get back two guys, one for sure who would start and one who could slot into player number 9 or 10 in your rotation, that's a huge win to me, even if you're not in love with Buddy Hield.
As is getting off of Vando's contract, right? Because one of the things that I laid out in that solo pod was that Vando's value more so conveys next season when he's an expiring deal. So if they're able to move him now, I would much rather have the championship team or bump up against that second apron as soon as possible. Let's do it next summer. They can't do it this year because they're capped at the first apron, but being able to trade Vando, I think, would be a team-building benefit as well. It sort of moves up the timeline to really max out what you do. So let's wrap up here, though, on the question of what needs to happen for these deadlocks to be broken between the RFAs, Watson and Draymond, guys like that.
I wish I knew. I'm not going to pretend to have answers in these areas where there's so many machinations in each of these front offices that are looking for variables in order to, like, get the ball rolling, something for them. Like when you talked about it earlier about the Watson stuff dragging out, Rich Paul went on the record and basically said, we're comfortable letting this sort of play out over time. And we're going to be patient in terms of trying to get Watson the contract that we think that he deserves. Right. And we've said this the entire time, and this has been reported by other people, that Watson is very likely looking at the Christian Brown contract and being like,
hell
yeah, at least as good as that guy. And that guy makes $25 million a year. Now, I get that you paid him 5 years, yada, 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 and maybe they don't want to be tied into a five-year contract at that number. But I would imagine they do want $20 million plus.
I feel like if they offered him 25 a year for 5 years, he would have signed that already, right?
But there's a big gap between that and like the MLE.
There is.
And he's a restricted free agent, and there are not machinations for him to go out into the marketplace, not many at least, to be like, get me this deal. But Rich Paul's not just going to sit there and be like, well, we'll just take the MLE. Thanks, guys. Like, right. That's not what he's going to do here.
Absolutely not. And that whole idea that there is nobody out there that has the money to be able to make offer sheets to any of these guys, Duren, Watson, Mathurin as well, that to me is what the real pressure for them is time. I could totally see it being very similar to the Kuminga situation, where we're sitting in freaking mid to late September. We got training camp coming up in a week, and Peyton Watson's still unsigned. Now, there was a Mark Stein report today saying that him and Duren are considering playing on the qualifying offer, which is the annual sort of empty threat, or at least it has been so far. Quentin Grimes, one of the few who's actually done it, and he got an okay deal out of it from the Lakers, starting at, what, 13-something million, 15 average over the course of 4 years. But you leave so much money on the table with taking the qualifying offer that it's somewhat of an empty threat. But D, because there's nobody that can offer this money, like the next time there's any pressure at all to actually get it done on any of the RFAs is when training camp starts.
It is, although the thing that I will say could push Denver to start to do things earlier is that they've got so many empty roster spots, Pete, and the second apron is going to make it so that, okay, what are they going to do? Just fill out their roster with minimums? Mm. They might, but I think they need to move pretty soon to determine, are they going to be this high of a tax-paying team, right? I think I saw Bobby Marks tweet something out that since the 2004-2005 season or 2005-2006 season, Denver's paid $53 million total in luxury 20 tax years. Payments. So it's been 20 years and they've paid $53 million total.
And now their tax bill is what, like $68 million at the moment with the current
market? Maybe even higher than that. It's a crazy number for them. So are we saying that the historically sort of, I don't want to call them cheap, but the historically like penny pinching, very strict in terms of their spending team organization going to suddenly be like, oh no, well, we're going to spend like we're Steve Ballmer's Clippers?
Right.
Or Joe Lacob's Warriors during the era of the KD super contract boom? I don't envision that happening at all.
I don't either, but you do have the counter pressure of the best player in franchise history being eligible for an extension but not willing to sign it at this point because he wants to see what kind of team gets put together. And so I don't think they're going to go down that route for the reasons that you put forward, but it's not like it's an easy decision. And if they come back to start this year just filling out the team with vet minimums, what the hell is Nikola Jokic going to think?
Yeah, and this is why before it was announced that Denver was going to match the offer sheet for Spencer Jones, I envisioned there being two pathways for Denver. One was they weren't going to match. They were going to stay under the second apron and sort of maintain the flexibility to sign and trade Watson or trade Cam Johnson and then sign Watson, but keep their powder dry a little bit and just let a good player walk, but maintain the limited flexibility that they still have. The second pathway was they match. And once they matched, I envisioned there being a scenario where that delivers a pathway for them to say, we can't really sign and trade Watson now. So what are we going to do to get back under the first or the second apron in order to prioritize Watson while keeping Jones? Because that sort of gives us our forward rotation with Aaron Gordon, Watson, and Jones being on the wing there. And then they also signed Marvin Bagley. They've got Daron Holmes, who they drafted a couple years ago, and sort of going that route. And so I do think, Pete, that this does sort of open the path for them to say, all right, well, let's build this team out the best way that we can. Let's maybe get something back for Cameron Johnson, who is not a starting level player, but a rotation level player that saves us money while also being able to pay Peyton Watson. And then we kept Spencer Jones. And now we're going to build out the rest of our team. They don't have to take back $23 million in salary when they trade him. They could save the money, give it to Watson, but we got a rotation player back and this is what we're doing. And that's where I think this is going.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Same. And that's part of the reason why the Lakers are an option for them is they're one of the few teams that have that immediate need for a wing like Johnson, but is also underneath the first apron to a degree that they can save Denver a legitimate amount of money while also trading back like decent players, right? Guys who can contribute. Not starting level guys, but guys who can actually help them out. So we shall see which way it goes. All right, this has been fun. We will be back tomorrow, talk more Lakers. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound of Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant. 48 points. 16 rebounds. Shaq with his 8th block. An NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me?
Unreal.
Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Ready pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two, one, miss it.
Unbelievable. It's over.
And shot clock now to 5. Bryant.
Yeah.
And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.